Good evening, everybody. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. This is the Malloy program. We're going to be talking a bit tonight about reaction to the leaks from WikiLeaks. If you are a conservative or Republican or support the criminal activities of several U.S. administrations, including the one that is in power right now, leave. Turn your radio off. Go someplace else because you're not going to want to hear this. I'm kind of breaking a rule during the third hour. I have scheduled a senator, a U.S. senator, who's going to appear on behalf of a candidate. The senator is Mark Begich. He's the junior senator currently from Alaska, former mayor of Anchorage. He's the one that defeated Ted Stevens. And he is going to be on the program to speak on behalf of Scott McAdams, who is running against both the fascist brown shirt Joe Miller and the Republican ultra-right winger Lisa Murkowski. That's the third hour. Now, speaking of Joe Miller, and I wouldn't have thought this to be true. Well, I would have, because the woman that sent it to me, I trust what she sends, but she also sent a YouTube video along with it, which we will post before the program's over at our website, MikeMalloy.com. Here's the story from Sue. Mike, Eric Cantor was scheduled to appear at a coffee shop in Louisa, Virginia this morning. Several volunteers for Cantor's opponent, Rick Wall, went to the coffee shop to hear Cantor speak, and they hoped to get a chance to ask questions. One of the volunteers was a man named John Taylor. His car was parked in front of this coffee shop, and on the car were stickers touting Rick Wall, not Eric Cantor. The owner came over to the table where John Taylor, his son, and two women with small children were having a cup of coffee and a bite to eat. The owner came over, and now keep in mind they're paying customers in the establishment, and asked him, the owner asked John Taylor and the people he was with to get out of his restaurant. And he said he refused to leave before they finished their coffee and whatever pastries they had that they had paid for. The owner called the police. Now, the video I'm going to post, because I can't even play it for you because it has several F-words in it. But the video that we're going to post will show you the police literally twisting this man's arms, John Taylor's arms, forcing great big fat-ass cops, two whites and a black, just smashing this man to the pavement because he had a sticker on his car, a bumper sticker, that was not Eric Cantor. Now, if anybody should know better, it would be Eric Cantor, who happens to be Jewish, who has family members who suffered this at the hands of the Nazis or the Russians or the Italians or the Georgians or the Czechs or the Polish. But Eric Cantor, the number two or three man in the House, has said not a word. Son of a bitch. Okay, we'll post it later. I just wanted to let you know that we're going to put that up. Eric Cantor. I guess when it becomes known that Joe Miller can order his military thugs to handcuff and arrest someone, a reporter who wants to ask questions, then Eric Cantor certainly must feel the right to call the police or Okay, Eric Cantor didn't call the police. But to stand by with his thumb up his nose when the owner of the restaurant where Eric Cantor is going to appear calls the police to have somebody thrown out of his establishment and arrested because he's got a bumper sticker on. Jesus Christ. All right. You need to understand something, Truth Seeker. This country with the invasion, I'm going to start there. I'm not going to go back historically to what the military industrial establishment of this country has done for the past 100 years. Why bother? If you don't know this history already, shame on you. But the history of the Iraq War, like the history of the war in Afghanistan, is dribbling out in little bits and pieces, and what is coming out is not the truth. Everything that is coming out, that has come out by the military-industrial establishment, the security state that now runs the United States of America, everything has been coming out and filtered through a press corps that 95% of which is afraid of its own shadow, wouldn't report an assassination if they saw one in front of their goddamn faces. That's what we're left with right now. So the only way the truth is going to get out is through these WikiLeaks document dumps. And it's turning out that the 400,000 documents released by WikiLeaks, and keep in mind what those documents are. They are not strategic planning documents. They are not about weapons and tactics. What they are about are reports as filed by soldiers, by non-commissioned officers, by witnesses, by people who reported up the chain of command what they were witnessing on the ground in this invasion and occupation that we perpetrated against the people of Iraq because we insisted in having their oil. Period. But my God, you need to accept something, Truth Seeker. Over the past 10 years, the atrocities that we have committed against Muslims, Arab speakers, are just astonishing. When I read some of these reports, it reminds me of what I have read mostly in literature, because reports from World War II are still classified. But it reads like some of the stuff I've read in literature that Japanese military did to the civilians of the Philippines and Manchuria and China and Korea. This is unbelievable stuff. And that's the reason the story is dead. Did you hear anything about it over the weekend, except on those filthy, disgusting capitalist talk shows on television? Well, what do you think of this? Well, I don't know. Sometimes you... Have you seen anything? Have you heard anything? Okay, the New York Times, the Washington Post, LA Times... But who reads those papers outside of L.A. and New York and Washington? Now, when we come back, I'll tell you about, among other things, the Wolf Battalion. The Wolf Battalion. I'm not going to tell you directly about it, but I'm going to report what was in... what our military affairs correspondent sent me from The Guardian of the UK. You never heard of the Wolf Battalion? Well, you're familiar with what it did, because the guy who was our man on the Wolf Battalion was one of the people who was involved in the deaths and torture of people in Central America during the Reagan years.
The Mike Malloy Show. You are now entering a flying monkey free zone.
21 past the hour. From the Guardian of the UK, fresh evidence is found in these WikiLeaks logs that U.S. soldiers handed over detainees. That would be anybody in Iraq. To an Iraq torture squad. The field reports published by WikiLeaks contain an official account of deliberate threats by military interrogator to turn more of his captives over to the Iraqi so-called Wolf Brigade. The interrogator would tell prisoners that, quote, he would be subject to all the pain and agony that the Wolf Battalion is known to exact upon its detainees, end quote. This evidence emerged as Britain's Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, said the allegations and reports of killings, torture, and abuse in Iraq were, quote, extremely serious and, quote, needed to be looked at, end quote. Clegg did not rule out an inquiry into the actions of British forces in Iraq, but he said it was up to the U.S. administration to answer for the actions of its forces. The the Deputy Prime Minister's comments contrasted with the statement from the Ministry of Defense in the UK today, which warned that the posting of classified U.S. military logs could endanger the lives of British forces, which I might add is one of the most nauseatingly hypocritical points of view anybody could take. The assistant prime or associate or deputy prime minister said, quote, we can bemoan how these leaks occurred, but I think the nature of the allegations are extraordinarily serious. They're distressing to read about, and they're very serious. I'm assuming the U.S. administration will want to provide its own answer. It's not for us to tell them how to do that, end quote. Well, Mr. Deputy Prime Minister, I have news for you. The United States government, under Barack Obama, or under anybody, is not going to do anything. Within the huge leaked archive is contained a batch of secret field reports from the town of Samarra. They corroborate previous allegations that the U.S. military turned over many prisoners to the Wolf Brigade, the feared 2nd Battalion of the Interior Ministry's Special Commandos. The field reports correspond with allegations made by New York Times writer Peter Moss, who was in Samarra at the time. He told Guardian Films, quote, U.S. soldiers, U.S. advisors were standing aside and doing nothing while members of the Wolf Brigade beat, tortured, and executed prisoners. The Interior Ministry of Iraq, the commandos took over the public library in Samarra and turned it into a detention center. An interview conducted by Peter Moss in 2005 at this improvised death camp, accompanied by the Wolf Brigade's U.S. military advisor, Colonel James Steele, was interrupted by the terrified screams of prisoners. Steele, Colonel James Steele, was previously employed as an advisor to help crush an insurgency in El Salvador. Now, I'm not sure if that is the most recent insurgency, or if that was the one in the 80s. If it was the one in the 80s, Colonel James Steele was probably in his 30s back then and is now would have to be in his 60s. But if it was the one in El Salvador in the 80s, tens of thousands of campesinos, peasants, whatever you want to call them, union organizers, relief workers, aid workers, were butchered. Their hands tied, their legs tied, shot in the back of the head. and then their heads cut off. We did that. We did that. And our butcher in El Salvador, in either that so-called insurgency, or the one most recently when the government of El Salvador, there was an attempt made to overthrow a more liberal government. I'm not sure. I'm not sure which insurgency they're talking about, but it doesn't matter. This is what we've done. The Wolf Brigade was created by the U.S. in Iraq and supported by the U.S. in an attempt to reemploy elements of Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard. This time, to terrorize so-called insurgents. Members typically wore red berets, sunglasses, and balaclavas and drove out on raids in convoys of Toyota Land Cruisers. They were accused by Iraqis of beating prisoners, torturing them with electric drills, and executing suspects. We'll be right back.
Up America, one flying monkey at a time. It's more Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. So the WikiLeaks documents continue to dribble out here and there. They're not going to be commented on by any electronic media, especially not television. Insofar as what they reveal truthfully about what we and the UK got involved in, and the crimes, the war crimes that we committed. The Wolf Brigade is one of the crimes that we committed. We set it up. We staffed it. We staffed it with Saddam Hussein's terrible, terrible former members of the Republican Guard that George Herbert Walker Bush had sworn was the worst collection of military thugs since Hitler's SS. Do you remember that? You have to be a certain age to remember that. That was the first Gulf War that George Herbert Walker Bush committed American troops to because the Saudis requested it. Anyway, it is unclear which U.S. unit filed the report that complained that detainees were being tortured and executed by the Wolf Brigade. The entry describes the capture of prisoners near the town of Fallujah, west of Baghdad. The war logs also disclose that Wolf Brigade members were themselves at risk of reprisals. In January 2007, U.S. soldiers reported a gruesome discovery in a street near Baghdad. Quote, only the severed head was found. A wire was run through the ear with the corpse's ID attached to the wire. 3rd Battalion commander identified the remains as Adel Abu Hussein. He was an officer in the National Police Wolf Brigade. Lawyers in the UK are saying that the reports may embroil British as well as U.S. forces in this culture of abuse and extrajudicial killings. Well, not in this country. No, 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 no. We don't do that. We don't do that at all. And then Robert Fisk, yesterday or today, writing at the Independent of the UK, he writes, as usual, the Arabs knew. They knew all about the mass torture, the promiscuous shooting of civilians, the outrageous use of air power against family homes, the vicious American and British mercenaries, the private contractors, the cemeteries of the innocent dead, all of Iraq knew because they were the victims. Only we could pretend we did not know. Only we in the West could counter every claim, every allegation against the Americans or the British with some worthy general. For example, the ghastly U.S. military spokesman Mark Kimmett and the awful chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Peter Pace, come to mind. Only every allegation against the Americans would send out some general to surround us with lies. Find a man who'd been tortured, and you'd be told it was terrorist propaganda. Discover a house full of children killed by an American airstrike, and that too would be terrorist propaganda or collateral damage or a single phrase, "We have nothing on that." Of course, we all knew they always did have something. And yesterday's Ocean, or Friday's Ocean of Military Memos proves it yet again. Al Jazeera has gone to extraordinary lengths to track down the actual Iraqi families whose men and women are recorded as being wasted at U.S. checkpoints. And it was the Independent of the U.K. on Sunday that first alerted the world to the hordes of undisciplined gunmen being flown to Baghdad to protect diplomats and generals, these mercenaries who murdered their way around the cities of Iraq. Abused me when I told them I was writing about them way back in 2003. As an aside, I read something, a little blurb in the Times, I think Saturday, that the murderers of Blackwater are not going to be prosecuted, that all charges are going to be dropped here in the United States. Back to Robert Fisk. In the written, bleak militaries of these documents, there is the evidence of America's shame. This is material that can be used by lawyers in courts. If 66,081, I love the 81 bit, if 66,081 is the highest American figure available for dead civilians, then the real civilian mortality score is infinitely higher, since this records only those civilians the Americans knew of. Some of them were brought to the Baghdad mortuary in my presence, Fisk writes, and it was the senior official there who told me that the Iraqi Ministry of Health had banned doctors from performing any postmortems on dead civilians brought in by American troops. Now, why should that be? Because some of them had been tortured to death by Iraqis working for the Americans. Did this hook up with the 1,300 independent reports of torture in Iraqi police stations? We still haven't gotten to the bottom of the WikiLeaks story, and I rather suspect, Fisk writes, that there are more than just a few U.S. soldiers involved in this latest revelation. Who knows if it doesn't go close to the top? In its investigations, for example, Al Jazeera found an extract from a run-of-the-mill Pentagon press conference in November 2005. Peter Pace, the uninspiring chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is briefing journalists on how soldiers should react to the cruel treatment of prisoners, pointing out proudly that an American soldier's duty is to intervene if he sees evidence of torture. Then their camera moves to the far more sinister figure of Donald Rumsfeld, who suddenly interrupts, almost in a mutter. And to Pace's consternation, Rumsfeld says, quote, "I don't think you mean the American soldiers have an obligation to physically stop it. It's to report it." The significance of this remark, cryptically sadistic in its way, was lost on the journalists, of course. But the secret FRAGO 242 memo now makes much more sense of the press conference, presumably sent by General Ricardo Sanchez. This is the instruction that tells soldiers, quote, "Provided the initial report confirms U.S. forces were not involved in the detainee abuse, no further investigation will be conducted unless directed by HHQ, higher headquarters." Abu Ghraib happened under Sanchez's watch in Iraq. So Sanchez's message, it seems, must have had Rumsfeld's imprimatur. And so General David Petraeus, widely loved by the U.S. press corps, was presumably responsible for the increase in U.S. airstrikes over 2 years. 229 bombing attacks in Iraq in 2006, 1,447 in 2007. Interestingly enough, U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan have risen by 172% since Petraeus took over there, which makes it all the more astonishing that the Pentagon is now bleating that WikiLeaks may have blood on his hands. The Pentagon has been covered in blood since the dropping of the atom bomb on Hiroshima in 1945. And for an institution that ordered the illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003, to claim that WikiLeaks is culpable of homicide is preposterous. Chris Hedges. Ooh, scary writer. If ever, he writes, I am tempted by the siren songs of my tribal past as a deep-fried yellow dog Democrat, and I begin to feel any faint atavistic stirrings of sympathy for the old gang, I simply think of things like the scenario below, sketched last week by Johan Hari, a British journalist. And those wispy ghosts of partisanship past go howling back to the depths. Quote, Johan Hari. Imagine if an hour from now a robot plane swooped over your house and blasted it to pieces. The plane has no pilot. It is controlled with a joystick some 7,000 miles away, sent by the Pakistani military to kill you. It blows up all the houses in your street, and so barbecues your family and your neighbors until there's nothing left to bury but a few charred slops. Why? They refuse to comment. They don't even admit the robot planes belong to them. But they tell the Pakistani newspapers back home it is because one of you was planning to attack Pakistan. How did they know? Somebody told them. Who? You don't know. And there are no appeals against the robot plane. Now imagine it doesn't end there. These attacks are happening every week, somewhere in your country. They blow up funerals and family dinners and children. The number of robot planes in the sky is increasing every week. You discover they are named Predator or Reapers after the Grim Reaper. No matter how much you plead, no matter how much you make it clear that you are a peaceful civilian getting on with your life, it won't stop. What do you do? If there was a group arguing that Pakistan was an evil nation that deserved to be violently attacked, would you now start to listen? This is, in fact, an accurate description of life in much of Pakistan today, with the sides flipped. The Predators and Reapers are being sent by Barack Obama's CIA with the support of other Western governments, and they killed more than 700 civilians in 2009 alone, 14 times the number killed in the July 7th attacks in London. The floods there recently were seen as an opportunity to increase the attacks. And last month saw the largest number of robot plane bombings ever, 22. Over the next decade, spending on drones is set to increase by 700%. More in a moment. 4,000 people.
Hey, truth seekers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. I realize it's very hard for Democrats to get their heads around, especially Obama supporters. But back to Chris Hedges, who writes, friends, it's very simple. If you support Barack Obama and the Democrats, even if reluctantly, even if you're just being all sophisticatedly super savvy and blogospherically strategic about it, playing the long game or 11-dimensional chess or what have you, you are supporting the outright murder of innocent people who have never done anything against you or yours. You have walked into a house, battered down the bedroom door, put the barrel of the gun against the temple of a sleeping child, and pulled the trigger. This is what you are supporting. This is what you are complicit in. This is what you yourself are doing. But hey, let's be all super savvy and 11th dimensional ourselves here for a moment. Let's be pragmatic and technocratic. Let's be grown-ups. Let's not get sidetracked by a bunch of jejune dorm room hippy-dippy moralizing. No, let's concentrate on practicalities. Let's get down to brass tacks. Let's be serious and focus on what works to protect our national security, okay? So here's the practical result of the illegal campaign of mass murder that Obama is waging on the sovereign territory of one of America's allies. Quote, back to Yohann Hari. Drone technology was developed by the Israelis, who routinely use it to bomb the Gaza Strip. I've been in Gaza during some of these attacks. The people there were terrified and radicalized. A young woman I know who had been averse to political violence and an advocate of peaceful protests saw a drone blow up a car full of people. And she started supporting Islamic Jihad and crying for the worst possible revenge against Israel. Robot drones have successfully bombed much of Gaza, from secular Fatah to Islamist Hamas to the brink of jihad. And the same thing happening in Pakistan. David Kilcullen is a counterinsurgency expert who worked for General Petraeus in Iraq and now advises the State Department. He has shown that 2% of the people killed by the robot planes in Pakistan are jihadis. The remaining 98% are as innocent as the victims of 9/11. 98% of the dead are as innocent as the victims of 9/11. He says, quote, "It's not moral," end quote. And it gets worse. He says, quote, "Every one of these dead non-combatants represented an alienated family and more recruits for a militant movement that has grown exponentially as drone strikes have increased. It could be poised to get even worse. Bob Woodward's book, Obama's Wars, says the U.S. has an immediate plan to bomb 150 targets in Pakistan if there is a jihadi attack inside America." Back to Chris Hedges. Well, it's almost as if the drone campaign was designed to create more and more enemies and more contracts for war profiteers to build more and more drones, which can then be used to create more and more enemies, which means more and more contracts for... Say, wait a minute, it is a practical plan, after all, a practical plan to create terrorism, not quell it. Now, what is the evidence, the so-called evidence used by the Obama administration militarists as they draw up their target list for the defenseless villages in Pakistan? What is the so-called intelligence produced by the $75 billion lavished on our 200,000 security apparatchiks every year in this country? On what basis is Barack Obama killing people in Pakistan? Yohann Hari. Quote, "The press release is uncritically repeated by the press after a bombing. Always brag about senior al-Qaeda commanders killed. But some people within the CIA admit how arbitrary their choice of targets is. One of their senior figures told the New Yorker magazine, quote, sometimes you're dealing with tribal chiefs. Often they say an enemy of theirs is al-Qaeda because they want to get rid of somebody. Or they make crap up because they wanted to prove they were valuable so they could make money," end quote. Chris Hedges. That's right. Barack Obama is killing hundreds of innocent civilians in Pakistan on the basis of crap made up for money. Made up crap for money. That's why a child who is just as precious as your child is to a parent who is just as real a person as you are was killed this week by Barack Obama and the Democratic Party and the entire bipartisan foreign policy establishment of the United States of America. Crap made up for money. And of course, it's not just tribal chiefs making up crap for blood money. The entire aforementioned bipartisan foreign policy establishment in this country is now and has for years been making up crap so they could make money. for themselves, for their corporate patrons, for their government agencies, for the defense and so-called security stockholdings, for the perpetuation of their bloated, belligerent, pig-ignorant domination of world affairs and American society by killing innocent people all over the world. But oh my gosh, oh my Lord, we have to support Obama. What if those Tea Party Republicans get into power? What would happen then? What would happen? The same goddamn thing that's happening right now. That's what. More and more war, more and more murder, more and more domination by a militarist kleptocracy. As Glenn Greenwald notes this week at Salon, Obama and the Tea Partiers and the neocons and the liberal hawks and the Bush regime war criminals are in lockstep, goose step, on keeping the war machine stoked and rolling. And that's why the opposition to the Tea Party Republicans has been so anemic, focused almost entirely on personality flaws or asinine comments or resume padding or stupid things they did in college. The Democrats can't possibly attack them on substance. More when we come back. If you can take more. If you can't and you want to bail out, I understand. Quoting from a couple of recent pieces, one by Chris Floyd, one by Robert Fisk, and of course from the WikiLeaks document dump that involves the illegal invasion and occupation and subsequent murder and torture of tens of thousands of innocent civilians led by the United States and its coalition partners. And the criminal acts that were committed, the war criminal acts that were committed by every single member of the Bush administration who were involved in this, and now every single member of the Obama administration who are involved in the crimes that are being committed in Afghanistan. And they are crimes. And Pakistan. Especially Pakistan. Our mission, if we ever had one, in Afghanistan, which began 10 years ago, was to destroy the bases of Al-Qaeda that were being financed by, of course, the Saudi royal family, the Bush business partners. According to several people high up in the ranks of U.S. military, those camps, training areas, or Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan were reduced down to about 50. And at the most recent move by the Obama administration was to increase military presence, U.S. military presence in Afghanistan by 30,000. That wasn't good enough, of course. The idea that we have the right to bomb and kill innocent people in Pakistan is doing one thing, and one thing only. It's not stopping anything. It is building a multi-generational resistance force that will go after Americans. Eventually, they will strike in this country, and they will strike because their babies were killed. Their children were burned alive. Their parents were roasted by our weaponry. Their families, their homes were destroyed by drone attacks for no reason whatsoever. Now, we can't avoid that. We can talk around that. We can pretend like, well, you know, we can call it anything we want. Call it collateral damage. Call it alphabet soup. I frankly don't give a goddamn what you call it. It is still murder of innocent people. And it's being perpetrated against people who have no defense whatsoever. As Johann Harry said, imagine tomorrow morning. Drone aircraft controlled by Pakistanis 7,000 miles away kills your children. What are you going to do, truth seeker? What are you going to do? As long as these wars, as long as these occupations and this murder continues, as long as these kinds of immoral acts are carried out by the people we elect, do you expect any problem in this country ever to be solved, ever to be worked to a just conclusion when we are doing this? Do you really? Are you that goddamn insane? Excuse me. I'm sorry. I get very upset about this. I don't like bombing civilians into red mist. I just don't like it. Back to Chris Hedges, who lays a lot of this, and rightfully so, on the Obama administration. This is his war. It is his occupation in Iraq. It is his. Hedges says that's why the opposition to the Tea Party Republicans has been so anemic, focused almost entirely on personality flaws or asinine comments or resume padding or stupid things they did in college. The Democrats can't possibly attack them on substance, i.e. the fact that the Tea Partiers are rabid warmongers who delight in murder, torture, and repression and believe that the poor, the sick, the old, the weak, the unlucky, and the vulnerable should just eat blank and die already, because these are the same positions the Democrats hold. Who, quote, reformed, end quote, health care into a gargantuan guaranteed boondoggle for rapacious conglomerates? Who bailed out the bankers and left millions in the hands of savage robo-signers? Who set up the so-called cat food commission and stocked it from top to bottom with long-time, deep-dyed haters of the poor and the weak? It wasn't Dick Cheney, bub. I don't want to see the Tea Partiers in power, but I'm not going to support one faction of murderers and plunderers just to keep out another faction of murderers and plunderers. Johann Harry makes this good analogy about the drone program, quote, yet many people defend the drones by saying, we have to do something. If your friend suffered terrible third-degree burns, would you urge her to set fire to her hair because you have to do something? Would you give a poisoning victim another worse poison on the grounds that any action is better than none? Hedges. Similarly, I say, would you support one murderer who likes to break into children's bedrooms and blow their brains out in order to stop another murderer who would do the same from taking over a vicious gang of murderers? What would be the basis, the reason for your support? That the first murderer wears nicer suits, digs cooler music, throws better parties, leaves a pretty little flower next to the blown out brains? For a system sunk so deeply in evil, there is no lesser evil to choose. The militarist kleptocracy itself is evil. And every political faction that does not denounce it and seek to dismantle it is complicit in this evil. The choice is to stand outside such factions. The choice is non-cooperation with evil, as advocated by Thoreau, Tolstoy, Gandhi, King. I'm not going to spend my brief time here on earth standing with blood-soaked killers, no matter what factional name they give themselves or what loyalties they might claim on our myth-clouded memories of the past. I'm not going to teach my children that all we can do is grovel before one child-murdering maniac or another, to keep quiet, to never speak the truth, to sell their votes, their dignity, and their souls to murderers who would pervert every good instinct and every bad instinct, every worthy hope and every nasty fear to keep themselves in power? Dead children, made up crap for money. That's what our leading dissidents want us to support by supporting the Democrats. There is much that could be said about the utterly puerile arguments being offered for this murder-abetting stance. But in the interest of brevity and civility and my own sanity, I will forbear and simply say, no thanks. Chris Hedges. This is, you know, when it's all taken together, it's very rough stuff. This is the age of peeling back, for some of us, for once and forever, the myth of the specialness of U.S. foreign policy or U.S. domestic policy. We have more people locked up than any other nation on earth as a raw number, as a percentage of our population also. Why? Why? Why do we have so many African-American men locked up? Why? Nobody asked that question in the political arena. Nobody. Who asked those questions? Why do we invade countries? Why are we bombing people? Who asked those questions other than Chris Hedges or Noam Chomsky or Johan Hari? Who asked those questions? We don't care, do we? Got too many other things to worry about. Got a mortgage payment. Got this, got that. Got, you know, sorry, can't do it. They're going to repossess my house next week, you know. Oh, by the way, make sure you go out and vote. And you know the irony of all this? Later on tonight, I'm going to have on a Democratic senator who is going to suggest, and he comes on by our invitation, he's going to suggest that you vote in the Alaska senatorial contest for a Democrat. And I want you to hear the interview. I really want you to hear the interview. We'll be right back.
The fact is there's these prisoners buried in the sand, mass murdered in containers. The fact is in Afghanistan more died than in New York, and most of them civilians. Hail Caesar! This is what you're fighting for. The king of death row, Texas, elected by his brother-in-law. Hail Caesar! This is what you're fighting for. Oil money, Enron, the American Empire!
Mike Malloy.
I guess you could hear that. 21 past the hour. If you're a regular listener to this program, you've heard me mention a couple of times about an internet radio program that certainly kicks ass and takes names to the same degree that this one does. I think Bob Kincaid might not use as nasty language as I use occasionally, but it's a head-on radio network, and you can, you know, head-on, as in a car wreck, headonradionetwork.com. And this is their fifth anniversary, which defies all the laws of nature that Bob Kincaid managed to keep it going that long. And he joins us now. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for inviting me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just mentioning again about Head On Radio Network, you know, for people who are not still not familiar with you. The format of your, well, you describe it, the format of your program, for people who don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
Oddly enough, the genesis to the whole thing lies in two places. One, you're the godfather, because the idea that I spent a lot of time in a former life driving around the roads at night, and every now and then I could get the you know, the skywave signal of WLS.
Oh, yeah.
In those days.
Oh, my God.
Into my little radio. And I was so, and also, you know, going back to the days when you were with WSD in Atlanta, driving home, you were working at CNN, so was I. I was over in the radio division. But you were what kept me sane after a day at work as I drove home to the little apartment complex across the Chattahoochee.
Mm-hmm.
And all along I kept saying, somebody else has got to do this. Somebody else has got to do this. And that combined with hearing the unmitigated filth that flows out of the Limbaughs and the Hannitys and the O'Reillys and the Savages and the rest of that crowd, I finally looked up one day and said, well, then why don't I? And a lot of things came together to make a little radio show happen in America's fifth smallest radio market, Beckley, West Virginia. And we were run off the air there by the right wing. And thanks to a dear, dear friend of mine, we call him Boss Man Wayne, he made it possible for us to not just go down in ignoble defeat, but to rise again on the Internet on October the 24th, 2005. And we figured out, we early on thought, well, hey, we'll go do, you know, real radio on the air. And then realized, come on, the coal industry and the right wing owns the airwaves, and the chances of us ever doing terrestrial radio are slim, and slim just rode out of town. So as a consequence, we thought about what radio might sound like if it wasn't subjected to the constraints of the older models.
Mm-hmm.
And we invented something here that we call conversation radio. And if there is a glory to the horn, it is the fact that we're able to, because of the lack of constraints, do long form radio conversations with workaday folks all across the country, and give them the time to be the experts that they actually are.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And,
sure.
And share their visions, their thoughts, their ideas, and frankly, yes, their anger and their frustration. And it's proven to be just a delightful, if harrowing, experience.
Well, that's one of the things that I think most people in over-the-air broadcasting can envy, and legitimately envy, not envy in the sense of one of the seven deadly sins, but envy in the sense of, you know, that must be a better way to do it. You guys operate with no time constraints. We are limited here because of the nature of broadcast. The longest segment I have in any given hour is probably, what, Kathy, 10 minutes? And then I have to break that conversation. I can come back to it. But as you know, you're flowing along and you break things. It's pretty hard to pick up the rhythm again when you come back. So the type of radio that you're doing, I wish more people would just wake the hell up and tune in. I mean, they don't have to do anything. Just log on to headonradionetwork.com. And by the way, I want to just say this again. I think I said it one time at some point, Bob. But to our audience on this program, The Malloy Show, we would not be on the air if it wouldn't have been for a piece of equipment that Bob Kincaid gave us. And what that is, for all you right-wing trolls out there, is the part of our broadcast setup here that is the 10-second delay that prevents you evil bastards from ever getting on the air and really unloading an F-bomb. Now, if people are listening on hold or people listening on the Internet, they'll hear it. And that doesn't make any difference. The only thing that matters is the fact that Bob Kincaid gave us a really expensive piece of equipment that we couldn't afford. We just couldn't afford to get. And he gave it to us so that we could go on the air. Bob, we're coming on a break. Let me put you on hold. We'll come back and chat a little bit longer, okay?
Sure thing.
All right, let me just put you on hold here. It's headonradionetwork.com is his website. Jesus, just go there. Just go check this program out. I mean, conversational radio. Like, okay, what's that? Check it out. We'll be right back.
Loud and clear, with a marble, I'd be gone, you can't stay there on the radio.
25 before the hour. No, I don't know who that was, but she's welcome to tune in. We're talking with Bob Kincaid of HeadOnRadioNetwork.com and it's the occasion of his fifth anniversary. And like I was mentioning right before we went the break, that were it not for a donation that he made to this program, we never would have gone on the air. And for that, America will hate you forever, Bob. I mean,
it is a hate that I joyously earn at that case, Mike. Before we go any further, I do want to convey. I was just asked by John Fox, who was chatting to me. You know, he's our engineer and our webmaster and our web designer. He's the host of his own show. He's worn a lot of hats, but he said, "Please say thanks to me for the support all these years, and love to Mike and Kathy and Molly, please." And I would be remiss if I didn't. Because so much of all this does center, so much of it comes back home to you, Mike. You and I have never met. I've never met John Fox. I've met Ben Birch twice. Mm-hmm. The whole thing started because Ben was podcasting you back in, golly, the IE America days.
Right.
And I contacted Ben, and Ben said, "Yeah, why not? Let's do this." And shortly thereafter, John touched base, and just the magnificence of all of this is, the way that a whole lot of people in a whole lot of different places have found a place to come together, just as they do with your show, to sort of cut the darkness and cut the distance,
mm-hmm.
and realize that we can have a sense of community, no matter how hard the miserable freaks on the right wing try to tell us that we're alone, we're surrounded, and we're doomed.
Mm-hmm. John is in Australia, right?
Right.
Yeah, he's located. He's your he has his own program on your network. He is your web designer. He's your engineer, and he's in Australia. Which I don't know why that. You know, I guess that quickly displays that I am above a certain age, that I still find that to be amazing that those intercontinental connections now exist as simply as. I don't know, as simply as if you had a correspondent in Charleston.
It's mind-boggling to me, too, but by dint of necessity, I've had to get used to it.
Right.
The nights that either I or my wife have held a webcam over the mixing board while John said, "Take the plug out of there and put it in there."
Oh, my God.
And you wind, wow, how did that happen?
Right. It's just, you know, it never fails to amaze me what those of us who are still remain on the so-called progressive left or whatever the hell you call us now, what we'll do to get a program on the air. I have lost more jobs, Bob, because they wanted to replace me with Dr. Laura, or I pissed off what's his name, the guy that used to head Disney and was also the head of Michael Eisner, the head of ABC. It just never stops. And I'm always fascinated with the determination of people on in our little niche of the left who just refuse to say, "No, I'm not going to do it, no matter what. We just keep doing it." Is there anything upcoming other than your regular broadcast that people should be aware of about your program, about your whole network?
We're constantly trying to expand. You know, we've had a lot of people come and go and do wonderful programs, but unfortunately they often find themselves having to go out and find real work and get paid. And this is all a volunteer effort, all the way down to the very anybody who's involved. What's coming up? One of the things that we have really been proud of is the fact that we've taken a lot of trips. I'm actively involved in the struggle against mountaintop removal,
mm-hmm.
and just using new cutting edge technology, we've been able to bring people a little bit closer to that issue with the rallies and protests and stuff that we've held. That there will be more of that coming in the future. Little road trips here and there. We've showed up at Netroots Nation a couple of times, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse. But mostly, it's the day-to-day goal of just getting another show done.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure. I know that feeling. Well, it is kind of risky. You're in West Virginia and Blackley, right?
Not far from, yeah.
And mountaintop removal is an issue that is, I think, to a large degree misunderstood by an awful lot of people who see coal mining as the only means of livelihood that they've had, their parents, their grandparents, going back God knows how many generations. And resistance to mountaintop removal is seen as resistance to their livelihood, their sense of community. And it's sad that that's how it's perceived. If we're going to continue to use fossil fuels until hell freezes over, there's a way to do it, and the mining companies know this, without destroying everything in West Virginia or Virginia or Kentucky or Tennessee, that stretch of Appalachia that has provided coal ever since it was first discovered. And that puts you at risk physically in that area of the country.
It certainly does. We've got I've got a dear friend who has been physically assaulted by coal company supporters during peaceful protests. But you know, Mike, I think the most important part of that is the realization. I've got a good friend who says we're all downstream.
Yeah, really.
And what is being done to the waters of Central Appalachia, which are literally the gathering places for the watering of most of the southeastern United States, is horrifying to behold. You know, it goes so in so many different directions. You've got people in McMansion communities there near where you live in the Atlanta area who've been made sick by their houses because their houses wallboard was made out of toxic coal fly ash. You've got people who whose internal organs are being burned up because of what's in their water, and they're so far they wouldn't know a mountaintop removal site if they saw one. Mm. But it's all directly related.
That's right.
And so as a consequence, you know, that what we're trying to do is get people to understand that even though you're not here in the hills are with you.
Yeah, that is so true. That is so true, and it's so true about so many of these so-called environmental issues that really are global now and affect everybody. You can't get away from it. Bob, listen, congratulations on 5 years. Obviously, I hope you go another five. I don't know what the hell is going to happen after November 2nd. Maybe just more of the same old, same old. But I think people should understand that there's always a program like yours that they can tune into, and it might be good to support this man, too. Bob Kincaid, and the network is headonradionetwork.com. That's all you have to know. Just go there. You can hear it on the stream from White Rose Society every night. If you're listening on Ben Burch's stream to this program, don't disconnect. When this program's over, Head On Radio Network with Bob Kincaid is on next. So just stick around. Bob, good talking to you again, all right?
Always great talking with you, Mike.
All right,
thanks,
man.
So much.
Take care.
Bye.
Take care. Yeah, it's always a struggle, isn't it? It's always a struggle. But if you want to hear unique radio, you know, I like to make a lot of claims about this program. But if you want to hear unique radio, and I realize there are other internet radio programs too, but you ought to hear. You ought to just tune in tonight to headonradionetwork.com. And again, congratulations to Bob Kincaid and his whole crew. All right, moving on. John is in Jackson, Mississippi. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike. Love the show. I just wanted to, I guess, take a little bit of issue with you on a point that it seems like you were driving home a little bit earlier.
Okay.
With regard to civilian casualties and civilian deaths, I think that, first of all, from a moral and ethical standpoint, minimizing civilian deaths in any conflict, whether a declared war or otherwise, is important. And I also think that over the long haul, maintaining the support of the American people, if you're going to have a sustained conflict, is going to require the minimization of civilian deaths, because I think most of us are bothered by civilian casualties. I think that it's only a small minority of Americans who aren't bothered by that. But if you say that any conflict or war in which there's civilian casualties is by definition an unjust conflict, then there's really no reason to have a Department of Defense any longer, because I don't know of any conflict that any country's ever been involved with in which there are not civilian casualties. And when militants, like Al-Qaeda militants or, you know, former members of the Taliban, scatter themselves among civilians or even among their own family, which always includes women and children who have no particular interest in the conflict, if you're going to take them out, you're always going to get, unfortunately, civilian
Let me ask you a quick question. You mentioned Department of Defense. Against whom are we defending?
In this particular case, in Afghanistan or Pakistan or in general?
In the three issues at hand where we are committing war crimes, Iraq, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, against whom are we defending? Who is our Defense Department protecting us from?
Well, I don't think we're necessarily defending ourselves at this point. I mean, you have
Hold on. John, I have to do a break here. Hold on just a second, and I'll come right back. Just stay right there. Don't go away. We'll come right back. We're talking with John in Jackson, Mississippi, who has called in. My question, I wasn't trying to be cute or anything, John, but my question is this massive Defense Department that now absorbs $750 billion a year out of the American taxpayer, when we certainly can't afford that, against whom are we defending now? I think you were about to tell me who.
Well, I think that in the case of Afghanistan and now Pakistan, which is where one of the combatants that originally were in Afghanistan had fled, we certainly have a group of people who view us as infidels and hate us and would use every means at their capacity to cause us harm.
Well, do you see that as justifiable in the craziness that is war? Do you see any justification for Arab speaking people or Muslim people globally to say we're going to strike back because the United States in its policies have murdered our people for the better part of a century, have taken our resources, have supported right-wing regimes like the regime in Iran the Shah of Iran that employed the SAVAK, a secret police organization that we put together that tortured their own people. And they're only able to do that with our support. Hamid Karzai, the current leader of Afghanistan, who is nothing if not a thug and a crook. I don't know if you saw the news today, but he stands on television and talks about how, Ahmadinejad gives him cash twice a year. As far as Pakistan is concerned, they have ostensibly been our allies since the country was formed, and yet we have assisted in the overthrow, I think, of two of their governments, and we're murdering their civilians. So do you see the possibility? I mean, what would you do, John, if Pakistan or Afghanistan or Iraq or Iran or any country were sending invaders here to steal our coal, to commit murder and mayhem as they chose? Would you respond?
Well, I certainly would not suggest that every foreign policy decision of this country over the past 50 years is related to the Middle East.
Well, the ones that have led us to this point, of course. I mean, do you think that one day Middle Eastern people or Muslims somewhere woke up and said, I think I'll go kill Americans? No provocation, no reason. Do you realize how many Muslims or Arab speakers live in the United States? Have you ever been to Dearborn, Michigan? Have you ever been to Southern California, the Los Angeles area that is chock-a-block with Iranians? Have you ever been to various parts of the United States where Muslim people, I mean, you're making an argument that can't be made, that for some reason we have a right to attack these countries and kill their people. When did they attack us?
9/11 and several times prior to
now,
that.
Now, wait a second. Now, I ask you and I'll ask you again. Is there any part of you that sees 9/11, the events that occurred that day, as a reaction to U.S. policy for the past half century in the Middle East?
That may have been used as a justification,
don't cheapen it. Don't cheapen it by saying it may be used as a justification. I'm saying, do you see, what would you have done? I mean, what would you have done if for the past half century, a Muslim country had invaded and murdered and killed and slaughtered and tortured your people here? What would you have done?
Are you suggesting that the Taliban can take the moral high ground when it comes to human rights and the way
no,
people
who,
are
who,
treated?
No, I'm not talking about the Taliban. It wasn't the Taliban.
Al-Qaeda?
It wasn't the Al-Qaeda is a CIA invention. Osama bin Laden is somebody that we trained and hired. Now, look, John, I don't mind talking with you about this stuff, but I'll tell you what, we're just about out of time. I think what you need to understand, and maybe you don't, is how we got to this situation. I mean, since 1948, we have supported the absolute suppression, killing, destruction of Palestinian people. Now, a lot of Americans will justify it and say, well, we had to support the Israeli, the Jews that came from all over the world and set themselves up as Israelis. We had to do it because of the Cold War. And you and I can sit back here in our on our American couches and say, yep, that's just the way it goes. But let me ask you something again, and this is not fair because you're not going to be able to answer. I'm just about out of time. But as we sit back here on our couches in America and watch television and chat about this stuff, and call each other on radio programs, how do you think Palestinian people feel that for 60 years they have been refugees in their own country, they have been murdered, they have been denied basic human rights? How do you think people in the Muslim world feel? It hasn't been Muslims never came here and took over our... Oh, God, I got to go. Listen, I appreciate you checking in, Scott, John, but there's no way that we can... there is no power on earth that you could exercise that would convince me that the United States is justified in any of its war-making policies since the end of World War II. It just can't be done. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come back. We have an interesting interview coming up next hour. Maybe you may find it as hypocritical on my part, but listen and send me an email. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy. It is 7 past the hour. Coming up in a few minutes, as promised, we'll be joined by Senator... Mike. Baggage. Yeah, I keep thinking about his dad, who was killed in a plane crash in Alaska. It's Rudy Baggage who will be joining us. His dad, Nick Baggage, disappeared in October 1972 during a flight from Anchorage to Juneau with then House Majority Leader Hale Boggs. Remember that? Well, no. Of course you don't. You're not old enough. But some of us remember that. A lot of people die in plane crashes. A lot of politicians die in plane crashes in Alaska. Anyway, Senator Baggage is going to join us very, very quickly here. About 20 minutes. I got what? At bottom of the hour? Okay. And kind of in relation to Senator Nick Baggage being on the program, speaking on behalf of Scott McAdams, who, as I mentioned earlier, is running against the legitimate brown shirt neo-Nazi, Joe Miller. There is no question. We talked about this last week. Mentioned again a little while ago this evening, there is no question that Joe Miller is cut from the same mold as the brown shirt fascists in Germany and Italy during the 20s and 30s. This is not an ad hominem attack against Joe Miller. This is just who he is. It's very simple. So it gets down to that question then, doesn't it, about Democrats turning out in the numbers that went to the polls in 08 to elect Obama, and whether or not the Democrats are going to do that again here in the off-year so-called election. The pundits are all saying no. I've seen reports of as many as 70 seats going to switch hands in the House, reminiscent of the Gingrich fraud that was perpetrated against America back in 94. And as soon as that Congress got seated, they made Rush Limbaugh an honorary member of that Congress. Jesus Christ, what a collection of sick bastards, I swear to God. The pundits have closed off this political season. The Democrats will be lucky to hold on to the Senate. Now, I've said before, let the bastards have it and see if America can survive 2 years. If we can survive 2 years with Republicans in control of the legislative branch, then if we can survive, then I think the American voter will understand what's really going to happen to this country and throw the bastards out for once and for all and return the Republican Party to what it is supposed to be, what nature declared it to be, a rump party of a bunch of freaks and morons who waddle around with their pants around their ankles screaming about the unfairness of those dirty damn socialist liberals. That's the way it should happen. As a matter of fact, I read in the Times yesterday that probably the best gift to Barack Obama and to ensure his 2012 reelection would be just that happening, the Republicans taking over the House and the Senate. Because then it would be a bloody battle royal, much like Truman had in 48, much like Clinton had in 94. Subsequent to 94. And if you look back at those Democratic presidents, you'll see an awful lot got done by the... Now, whether you agree with it or not is immaterial. Again, I'm talking about this from a political point of view, just political point of view. I've got my personal feelings about this whole system, and so do you. But if it is what we are being told it's going to be, a political a complete political sea change. Now, the pundits, the television freaks, they love to see this. They create tension where none exists because that's what television is all about. They create stress. Without stress, without tension, without the, you know, the bloody car wreck and the fire, the pictures of the forest burning down or the apartment building exploding, television has absolutely no meaning whatsoever. Somebody said it's radio with pictures. No, it's way beyond that. Television has to create the tension, the stress. That's why you hear so many commercials on television, run by these shadowy groups who only exist because Karl Rove put them together. And once this campaign season is over, they'll be retired until the next campaign season. But the television plays a pivotal role in getting criminals, moral criminals, elected. Pivotal role. And if you have you noticed, if you watch the television commercials, the only people who run for office are the filthiest, dirtiest, child-molesting, murderous, rat bastards on earth. If you look at the political ads, the television ads, right? I mean, both sides use that tactic. I mean, my God, it's like watching little 30-second-long horror films about the candidate's opposition. Do you know that John Jones actually murdered and ate a baby? And you're going to vote for him? You've seen those ads, I'm sure. Now, the only one who murders and eats babies is, what's his name? You know, the undead former vice president who wanders around, Cheney, looking for children that he can eat. But in the real world, television dominates and creates this tension. Can you imagine if it were not for television ads, how uncorrupted, I didn't say completely uncorrupted, but how uncorrupted, how many notches down the corruption would shift if it weren't for television? Right? You know that. So you have a choice this election season, Truth Seeker. So do I. I mean, I have a big choice staring me in the face. You know, you have to decide, don't you, whether or not to continue to participate in the system that shouldn't, it just shouldn't be this, it shouldn't be this way, should it, huh? I mean, when we citizens go to the polls to elect our leaders, is this the way it's supposed to be, where corporations theoretically, before the law, an equal voice to yours, but in reality, in practical application, they have a vote hundreds of millions of times more powerful than yours because of the money. Is this the way it's supposed to be? Is this what... No, of course not. The Founding Fathers warned against this. Lincoln warned against it. Eisenhower warned against it. Truman warned against it. Everybody's warned against it. But it continues to happen. I got a letter to share with you about this when we come back. It's from Andrew in Chicago. And... In an email, he pretty much encapsulates what I think a lot of us are thinking about. And then after the next break, at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by Senator Nick Begich. And we'll talk about, we're not going to, Nick Begich isn't running for office. He's a senator. He's a junior senator, or the senior senator from Alaska. Junior senator, excuse me. And, what's your name? Murkowski is the senior senator. And we're going to talk to Nick about the election of Scott, or Mark, about the election of Scott McAdams. Stick around. I saw it on TV. Never hear goodbye. past the hour. Mark Begich will join us in a few minutes. Senator Mark Begich, Democrat, junior senator from Alaska. Murkowski being the senior senator right now. She's running for re-election as a write-in candidate, having been moved out of her nominated slot by Joe Miller. Okay, Andrew in Chicago writes the following. Mike, while the idealist in me has hopes that Democrats would turn out on November 2nd to stop the fascist takeover of our government, the realist in me knows it won't happen. In a way, too, I hope it doesn't happen. Part of me hopes that every one of these dumbasses wins, these teabag types. So these ass-backward teabaggers will finally have to pay for their ungodly ignorance. A chance to finally experience government by the values they blindly consume from the Nazi sociopaths and right-wing media every time they plop themselves in front of Fox News or turn on their AM radios. It's time these people get a taste of their own medicine. To not only have views that are the antithesis of a just, well-functioning society, but also to bask in this stupidity and take pride in being labeled, quote, right-wing terrorists, end quote. To them, ignorance is knowledge. Social justice is communism. Tyranny at the hands of corporations and theocrats, real tyranny, is freedom. And besides this doublethink, they've absolutely rejected any remaining common sense. It's astounding that people could possibly support a candidate who knows so little about the very document they are supposed to be protecting, that they don't even know the basic premise of the First Amendment. Or a candidate whose response to accusations of racism is, those aren't Latinos, they're Asians. Or a candidate who handcuffs a reporter for no reason and whose approach to border security is akin to the Berlin Wall. In a way, letting them have the government could be a good thing. We have a system controlled by two political parties, one being a party of weakness and another being a party of hate and fear, both corrupt beyond comprehension. It is a system where a corporation declared a person can donate as much money as it wants to any campaign it wants without having to disclose any of it. A whopping $4 billion has been spent on the various polished idiots that the right have squeezed out this year. And if that doesn't work, they can always just rig the election now that they're using privately owned electronic voting systems. And this is just a general election. I shudder to think what they'll be spending in 2012. Maybe letting them have the system and letting them destroy what is left of it will finally allow this country to purge itself of the sickness that is the Republican Party, and also hopefully drag down the Blue Dog Democrats with them. Maybe a few years without Medicare or Medicaid or emergency services or infrastructure, and eventually Social Security, will finally be enough to remove this jingoistic smokescreen that Republicans have been using to blind the American people for 30 years. It will likely lead to revolution, and unfortunately a violent one at that, though when the dust finally settles, we can finally work toward the progressive social democracy that we desperately need. However, Andrew writes, I also fear that such an approach could horribly backfire. I worry that much of the right might be so incredibly blind and stupid that they will follow their masters to the death, no matter how bad things get. As long as they are being led by someone constantly waving a flag or carrying a Bible, the filth that lies beneath these symbols is a moot point. By letting them have the system, we may be setting ourselves up for a corporatist, theocratic, militaristic state from which we cannot escape. It really puts progressives between a rock and a hard place. Do we attempt to continue to forge a place in a hopelessly broken system? Or do we take the chance of simultaneously bringing said system and the right wing down, yet possibly end up making them more powerful? I personally am still willing to take the chance and let them have it. But there is still that little voice in the back of my head that fears what could happen if we fail. The Tea Party and their ilk stopped being funny a long time ago. Seeing these teabaggers waving their misspelled signs around used to make me laugh and roll my eyes. But now they downright scare me. Because it looks like a good share of their candidates could win. With Election Day drawing closer, this is becoming like a nightmare from which we cannot awaken. All the best, Andrew in Chicago. Ha, Andrew, it is a dilemma, isn't it? I mean, it's an absolute dilemma. What to do, what to do, what to do. Well, maybe we can get some ideas from Mark Begich, who's going to join us right after this break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Inside your head. It's Mike Malloy.
Welcome back. 25 before the hour. Mark Begich is the junior senator from Alaska. He's former mayor of Anchorage. He served in the Anchorage Assembly State Legislature for almost 10 years before he was elected mayor in 2003. And in the 2008 Alaska Senate election, Begich defeated incumbent Ted Stevens, whose story you know. Ted Stevens at the time was the longest serving Republican member of the Senate. Mark joins us from his Washington, D.C. office, not to talk about his own reelection because he's not up for reelection, but to talk about Scott McAdams. Mark, thanks for taking time to join us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Right before the program, I took a look at Scott McAdams' website, scottmcadams.org, and the thing that was impressive to me is how many of those donors, he has published a complete list of every donor, how many of them are $10, $20, $30, $50 donors. I think the biggest donation is from your political action committee, but the people in Alaska and around the country seem to feel that Scott McAdams is desperately needed in D.C. Why is that?
Well, first, I appreciate you taking note of that. It's interesting when you look at those donors, they go down to as little as a dollar, which is unbelievable.
I noticed that. Incredible.
It was impressive, and it really shows the commitment that people are excited about who he is, because, you know, I knew him as a mayor, obviously, as a former mayor. I have a bias toward mayors. I think they're a great quality asset to have here in the Senate because they have to kind of understand all issues. They can't just focus on one thing, and you have to actually get things done, because as a mayor, what happens is if you don't get the work done, you hear about it at the grocery store, at the car wash, at, you know, your kid's school. You know, the person comes up to you and kind of lets you have it. So you got to be very proactive in getting things done. He's been a very successful mayor, a school board member, a president of the School Board Association for the whole state of Alaska, a family man. He's a fisherman, a commercial fisherman. He kind of has the well-rounded Alaska experience, and I think if you noted that you looked at his website, he is truly he's authentic.
Mm-hmm.
There's no packaging here. You get what you get, and he's a great guy, and he actually cares about the state. And he's in, you know, when he first got in the race way back in May, it looked like he would be running directly against Senator Murkowski, and you know, basically everyone gave him a less than 1% chance of even
right.
having a chance.
Right.
But he was willing to step up to the plate because I think what he is about, and this is what I've learned even more so watching him on the campaign trail is that he is just highly motivated to really show the American people there is a difference. And in Alaska, yeah, a lot of people didn't know what Senator Murkowski has done. You know, she wants to privatize Social Security. She wants to ship off Medicare to insurance companies and ship jobs to China, and the list goes on and on. And, you know, some of these Republicans have done a great job in hiding really their full agenda. And I think what Scott's done is just said, hey, here's where I stand, here's where she stands. And then there's also, as you know, the nominee, Miller, the Republican nominee.
Right.
He's done his own show and tell and drama. And I think what he's bringing into the race is kind of this, he's not interested in the drama. He's interested in coming down to Washington, D.C. and trying to get the business done.
You know, speaking of drama, this has got to have been and continues to be one of the most horrific election cycles I've ever seen. I have been politically active since the mid-60s, and I've never seen anything like this. I don't want to get too far into Joe Miller, because I do on this program. I have pretty much stripped the bark off of this guy as far as who he really is and who is really backing him. But right before you came on, Mark, in the segment just before this one, I had a letter from a guy in Chicago whose attitude is, the Democrats didn't do what we asked them to do when we elected Obama and gave Obama majorities in both houses. And frankly, people are really, really irritated. Now, I realize this is not a news flash. Everybody talks about all the anger out there, all the anger ginned up by people like Karl Rove and people like Fox Television Network and so on and so forth.
But
Sarah Palin. But there is some real frustration on the part of Democrats. And here's what I'm getting. I'm getting a lot of people saying, why should I continue to participate in the system? They're not going to do anything anyway. How do you answer that?
Well, here, you know, it's interesting. I just came back from Alaska last night. I was there this week, and when I were from Juneau, Ketchikan, Fairbanks, Sitka, Anchorage, Homer. I mean, it was a pretty cross-section of locations I went to. Probably had 50 different events I participated in. Some were sit-downs, some were speaking to groups, a variety from local business people to activists, you name it. And I want to first say I 100% agree. People are frustrated. I don't care if it's a Democrat or a Republican. They're frustrated. But then when I hear this frustration from Democrats to say, you haven't done enough, what I remind them is, can we do more? Absolutely. But we've only had like 18 months of something that took a decade plus, to be very frank with you, that messed up. I mean, you can't turn this ship around overnight. And I think we came out of an 08 election with such enthusiasm, excitement, and expectations. Not that it wasn't well-founded and grounded, but we thought we could get in there very quickly. But what we found is you have seen over the last couple of years a very toxic environment on the Republican side to just say, we don't care how good your idea is, we're going to be against it. And what they've done, their political desire over the last 2 years on our side is to bet against the American people, bet against to get this place, this country on the right track. Now, saying that, I tell people, and I've kind of gone against what my, you know, pollsters and political consultants tell me, is don't talk about stimulus, don't talk about, and I just say, look, we put a recovery plan on the agenda. It wasn't perfect, but it has made a difference. It has saved this economy from going down the tubes. I just saw a report today, this morning, existing home sales are up 10%, which is significant. There is more economic activity than ever before. If you had a 401k or a retirement program or an education account for your kids compared to a year ago, or almost 2 years ago now to where we are today, it's up over 30%. I mean, the facts are there. Now, are we lagging unemployment? Yes.
Well,
we have more growth there? Yes.
Yeah,
but as I described it, if I give you one data point, this is what's amazing to me. In Alaska, here's what I said. Before President Obama came into office, before the Democrats came into office, we were losing. The amount of jobs each month was equivalent to the full state population of Alaska, 700,000, 600,000, every month for 5 months. Basically, the population of the state of Alaska, totally unemployed every month. You know, we've turned it around. It's not been
well.
Easy.
That's where the problem is going to be, Mark. Trying to convince people when you talk about 401ks are up 30%. For the people who still have them. When you talk about existing home sales up 10%, how many of those were foreclosure home sales where people were turned out in the street and some speculator or somebody who wanted to take advantage of somebody else's financial collapse stepped in there.
Correct.
So the numbers, there's some turnaround. I look at the stock market this morning, 11,300. That means nothing when you have unemployment, an effective unemployment of around 16%. It just doesn't mean anything. And I think the big problem that Democrats are having and going to have, A, you're up against a tidal wave of cash from unknown sources, but B,
it's unbelievable how much.
Right, but B, and this may be A, people just don't believe it anymore. People watched, Democrats, progressives, me, watched over the past 2 years every single time that the Republicans threatened filibuster against something that could only have benefited the American people, the Democrats collapsed. Terry Reid collapsed. And that was it. And instead of calling the bluff and saying, all right, go ahead, stand in the well of the Senate and make a fool of yourself in front of the American people. This is what you guys have got to overcome.
Let me tell you, you are singing to the choir. I tell people all the time, there's two skills you need. There's lots of others, but two basic core skills you need in politics. One, you should be a good poker player and a bartender. And I'll tell you, what we have to do many times, and I agree with you, we got to take the fight, and win or lose, you take on the fight, because the American people, one thing they appreciate, and they understand that there are challenges, but they also appreciate taking on the challenges. What they don't appreciate is when you walk up the road and then you say, well, I think I'm going to stop now. And I think we as Democrats, I agree with you. That's why, as we talked at the beginning, people like Scott come into this with no interest other than the thousands of people who have come to him and given him those dollars and $10 and $20 donations. And he's going to come in, like I described to people, he's a commercial fisherman. If you've ever seen some of those shows, those guys on those boats, my view is he'll be perfect for the U.S. Senate, because when they come up and start playing the game, I think he's going to be one of these guys that's going to help push through what I think is the right message, and that is, look, we got to do some things, and if the Republicans want to vote no on it, that's a choice they get to make, and the public will decide their fate in the future. But if we sit here, and I agree, I think you're going to see, there's a freshman.
Mark, let me ask you, hold on, just hold on while I do a quick break. We'll come back.
Go make some money. Absolutely. We'll keep you on the air.
We'll come back and do about another 5 minutes. All right?
Sounds good.
Just stay right there. All right. We're talking with Senator Mark Begich, who is the junior senator from Alaska. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Talking for another 5 minutes with Senator Mark Begich. He is the junior senator from Alaska. He defeated incumbent Ted Stevens, the longest-serving Republican member of the Senate in 2008. He is not here to talk about his own campaign, but to talk about Scott McAdams. If you would, please go to Scott McAdams' website, scottmcadams.org. And if you want to see something very interesting, take a look at his list of donors. I don't believe the other candidates, very few candidates do this, publish an entire list of their donors. And what you'll notice about Scott's is how many of them are under $50. Mark, in a couple of minutes we have left here, about 5 minutes, can you make a strong case? I'd rather you do it. Make a strong case for why people like Scott McAdams and other Democrats should be elected. A lot of people have had it. with not just the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, but with the whole system.
The whole system.
Right. Yeah. So what is the strongest argument to do this again and for people to throw their support behind Democrats once again?
Well, I think it's a two-part. One, people have to be patient, but two, people like Scott are just so different. And what I mean by that is they haven't been, you know, decades in the legislative process. They have been active members of their community in ways that we want to see in the Senate. People who can come to the floor and say, you know what, I have looked in the eyes of people when I'm sitting there at the school board meeting or the mayor or the city council meeting and seeing the issues, work these issues, and they're not bashful. I think one of the things we have a bad habit, I'll be very frank with you, with Democrats, we sometimes, we're a little nice, which is great, but sometimes too nice. We got to sometimes shake it up and not afraid to take risk. Here's what politicians mostly have, and Scott, I think, is a different type of person. Mostly in campaigns, we'll take risk. In other words, to win the race, we'll get out there, talk hard about issues, and then when we get in office, we are like the most risk-adverse people in the world.
Mm.
And what we need to do is people like Scott, I mean, like I said, here's a guy who gets on a commercial fishing boat, which is high risk, to say the least, and he understands that you cannot just sit there and watch things go by. And I've seen him in action, and that's what we need. I'm a believer that you get in office and you got to then push the envelope and not worry, and I don't think he will do this. He will not worry about the next election. That's what too many of these guys do. They all think, oh, what do I say? How do I make it? What's the poll say? Put my finger in the air. And what we need to be doing a lot more, and I think augmenting the group that came in 08, look at what Tom Udall is doing. I mean, he's pushing the change in the rules, the way this place operates. This filibuster thing is killing us. He's not afraid to take on the powers to be. And I think that's what we need, and I think someone like Scott McAdams is not afraid to do that. And the most amazing thing is, in Alaska, for him to win, he needs a 32-33% to win the race.
Mm-hmm.
And people, and you said it, I mean, he's not bashful. He posted every donor, which is unheard of. I mean, usually it's, we got to check with the people under 200 because some didn't want to be known and all that. No, but he says, hey, you donate to me, it's public record.
Mm-hmm.
And that is it's a breath of fresh air, and I think that's what we need. And I got to tell you, he loves to joke about this, and if you look at his website, you'll know what I mean by this. He loves to say, this is one of his phrases, he says, he's a big man from a little town, just wants to make a big splash. And I'll tell you, he will. He'll come in here, and he will not sit around and have special interests push him around because, one, you just won't be able to, and two, he has an independent streak about him. And if you're a Democrat in Alaska, I got to be frank with you. If you're a Democrat in Alaska and actually put a D after your name, you are really a Democrat. you've put your name out there in a red, very red state. So I think he'll. I just watch him and people I see in meetings. It's most amazing. They come in, they have all this criticism, blah blah blah. Democrats this, and I don't have any faith. And they say, okay, I'll vote for Scott McAdams. They go in and they listen to him. They walk out, and these people are activated. And one thing, as you know, across this country, is this low enthusiasm rate. That's not the case in Alaska. I mean, I have been this whole week, and once he speaks, people hear it that are kind of, doubters or kind of disappointed the last 2 years, they come out of there revved up. And I'm like, okay, I wish we had more of these around the country, to be very frank with you.
Mm-hmm.
It would make a big difference for Democrats. And
well,
that's why you're seeing what you're seeing around the country, supporting him financially.
You know, it says on his website that his Native American name, or his Native Alaskan name, I won't even attempt the language, but it translates to English, boat-size killer whale.
That's right.
He is a big man. He has a great smile. I just hope that for the people who are going to take a chance on the Democratic Party yet again, and I hate to sound cynical, but the Democratic Party does not have a clean reputation, and the Republican Party is all dirty and filthy.
Right.
I think people understand that both political parties, to a lesser or greater degree, and I think we know which one is greater degree of corruption,
right.
But the Democratic Party has its share, too. That's one of the things that got me about Scott McAdams' website, the largest that I couldn't go through the whole thing. My God, it's just page
so
after
long.
Page
thousands.
After page. I must have gone through a good half of it, though, and the largest political campaign donation came from you.
That's right.
So
That's what he's coming in with, no hold bars. He doesn't have any obligation to anyone. He doesn't, and he's just that's who he is. And I guess, you know, I have my own thing that I do, and I go around and literally look for candidates who are mayors and recruit them for Congress, governor, and senator. And the reason I do that is for just this reason: mayors or that caliber of an individual, they face every single day the people. If you think about it, there's only one body. You know, the state legislature faces the speaker, the Senate faces the speaker or the majority leader. But when it comes to a local governing body, you sit in that forum, you're looking at the audience.
Yeah, well,
the people.
As a former mayor of Anchorage, you would know. Scott or Mark, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. I'll try to get as many people as possible to go to his website.
Fantastic.
And here's looking for better days in this country, I swear to God. Thanks, Mark.
Okay, thank you. Have a great day.
All right, sir. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Senator Mark Begich joined us from D.C. Go to his website, Scott McAdams, just like it sounds, McAdams.org. You decide. You decide. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.